You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by Leslie Mitchell-Clark, certified clinical hypnotherapist. Leslie has assisted numerous experiences over the last two decades, enabling them to unlock and uncover hidden memories and their encounters. We discuss the experiencer phenomena, how Leslie found herself working in this field, and some interesting, as well as rather disturbing cases she has been involved in. We also look at some of the explanations that are put forward to dispute or marginalise the experiencer community, how we can only learn from investigating these people's claims, and much more besides. As the show was recorded post-COVID, I apologise for my raspiness, but it's still a deeply interesting conversation about Leslie's life and work. But as always, before we get there, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters for $4 a month. Gets you early access, ad-free episodes, and bonus content. A big thank you and welcome to Nicola, my latest Patreon. You can also find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and don't forget you can subscribe to the channel on YouTube. You can also find the mysteriesandmonsters.com website with access to our episodes, news, and merchandise. As always, a big thank you to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork week in, week out, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Now, let's take a deep dive into the work of Leslie Mitchell-Clark and the experiencer phenomena. Today on Mysteries and Monsters, I am delighted to welcome certified clinical hypnotherapist, Leslie Mitchell-Clark. Leslie has helped numerous experiencers, enabling them to unlock repressed memories in regards to abduction and alien experience and their encounters therein. Leslie, I am delighted to welcome you for the first time to Mysteries and Monsters.
Oh, Paul, thank you so much for inviting me to be a guest and to have a wonderful chat with you today. I'm so looking forward to it.
Me as well, because this is a subject and a situation in regards to my deep interest in ufology, Leslie, that I've kind of rekindled. So my kind of first introduction to this subject was during the mid-90s when the world went UFO crazy, it would seem, and thanks to the X-Files and things like that, and the development in regards to certain famous cases around the world. And I came across a gentleman called Bud Hopkins.
Oh, yeah.
So Bud was my first sort of real introduction into this subject and the support and abilities of being able to assist people in unlocking what had gone on in their lives. For yourself, Leslie, the thing that struck me about your career is you are someone that has kind of come to this as a kind of second chance later in life.
Oh, yes.
Because obviously you've had a very varied career in the arts and entertainment industry for the better part of your sort of 30s and 40s. So is this a sort of rekindling of a change of direction as a teenager that's kind of led you back here later in life?
I think very much so in a way, because I did have an incredibly profound experience when I was, in fact, still a teenager. I was about 17, and I was having my first professional experience at what we call summer stock theater, a theater that just runs in the summertime, but it's a professional theater. And so, but my interest has always been in all of this kind of stuff, ancient aliens, you know, past lives, all of these kinds of things have always intrigued me. I remember when probably a big turning point for me would have been when Eric Von Däniken came out with his, it was practically a Super 8 film, 8mm film, Chariots of the Gods. And all my friends, you know, we piled into our cars and went to the drive-in of all places to see that. But that was a, do they have drive-ins in the UK? That's a silly question to ask.
We don't really have the weather for it. We try. No. I think we should call them shower-ins, really, Leslie. Yeah.
Oh my. Anyway, so yes, and I did have an interest from really began being piqued in the teenage years. And then as I worked my way through university, my job at university, the way I put myself through school, is I was a psychiatric aide at a state mental hospital. Mm. And that's a very grim kind of thing to be doing. You know, it makes Dartmoor Prison look like a spa. It was bad. And I continued on and became a psychiatric technician, which is like a psychiatric nurse. So even in times when my show business career was not really popping or happening, I would often work. I worked an awful lot in rehabs, drug and alcohol rehabs through my 20s. And then I was just so busy with the business that everything went by the wayside for a while. And as you say, I was really in midlife, and I was at the age where, you know, I was in transition as an actor. I wasn't going to be playing any ingenues anymore, and I wasn't quite old. I wasn't quite old enough to be an old lady yet, yes. You know, in film. So I was in the in-betweenies, and certain changes happened in the entertainment industry. You know, the record labels collapsed. I was in really the music business at that point. So everything was in a shambles, and I just really, I wanted to do something. I didn't know what. And my husband, bless his heart, for my birthday, he bought me a past life regression, which I thought, oh, well, this will be fascinating. And in fact, it was fascinating, but it was, what it really was, is the moment that the process began, I knew I can do this. I've done this before. Mm. I've done this in other lifetimes. I know what this process is, and I know I can do this. So I found or reconnected with something that I knew I could do to help people, not only with their everyday stuff and with grief and recovering from this and that, but I knew that I could become a regressionist and help people to explore their past lives. So very soon after that, I went through the amount of schooling that was required in our province in Ontario to become a practicing hypnotist. I took all kinds of other certifications. I'm actually a master hypnotherapist now. But at the time when I first started to work in clinic, shall we say, I was working at the Ontario Hypnosis Center, my dear friend Georgina Cannon's clinic. Mm-hmm. And you may know of Georgina because of her relationship with the wonderful actress Shirley MacLaine. And she even hosts sometimes. Shirley MacLaine had a very busy metaphysically oriented website, and she would host for Shirley. And anyway, yeah. There we were, and about once a month someone would call in just like out of the blue and speak in brevis about how they believe they had missing time, or they had woken up with marks on their body, or, you know, they thought that they saw beings in their room, any number of these types of things, and they wanted to experience a regression. Well, no one else in the clinic wanted anything to do with that. Mm. And I was already certified as a regressionist for past lives. So, you know, I wasn't reinventing the wheel here. I was simply adapting techniques that are tried and true that already exist. And I said, yes, send these people to me. And somehow, I talk about a brain signature getting out there and being identified. Somehow, I just started to receive queries from a number of these people who had these fragments of their experiences. And eventually, in those early days, I met Wes Roberts for the first time. He was referred to me by another hypnotherapist, a colleague of mine, who said, "Oh, I won't do this, but let me send you to Leslie." So Wes Roberts came, and we had our first session, and I think it was the first we began to collaborate on a book. I think it was, we had 40 some sessions altogether, but that was the real beginning, when I was finally practicing on my own, and people just through quantum entanglement, really, were finding me. The people that needed to find me were finding me. And eventually, I began working with MUFON directly, and I was one of the early founding members of Kathleen Martin's Experience Research Project. Yeah. And I still see experiencers who have filed reports with MUFON and have requested possible regression. So I work also with the free organization, the late Dr. Edgar Mitchell, no relation. Yes. Organization. So now, since the book a couple of years ago and a number of media appearances, now I really have a steady stream of individuals contacting me, both, and I do this work both online and in person. So I'm able to work with people really all over the world. And one thing I can tell you, Paul, about the experiencer phenomena, it crosses all racial, socioeconomic, spiritual belief systems, financial strata. It crosses every kind of line that you could think about. I have worked with attorneys and judges, and I've worked with people who can barely hold together and are on the dole. So it's a wide spectrum, but the commonality of these people, I believe, is psychic ability. I believe that every person who has had an encounter experience is able to communicate telepathically under the right circumstances. And I think that most of the evolved beings that we engage with do mostly communicate telepathically with the speed of thought, right? Which is the fastest thing in the world. So if you were to ask me why or what is the reason, who are these people that are being taken? Well, I can say pretty much without reservation that they all have innate psychic ability. Jane Goodall is in Africa. Imagine she's studying a new variety of simian creature. And, you know, like maybe three of them out of a whole massive group are starting to form words and having epiglottises or epiglottae that actually work. Now, wouldn't you, if you were Jane Goodall, rather focus on the three or four beings that were beginning to communicate? That's the analogy I would use for that.
Absolutely. I've often been very interested, Leslie, when I speak with anybody in regards to ufology or anybody that classes themselves as an experiencer, because I've always wanted to speak to somebody like yourself, because the big question for me is that first case that you get, that first person that comes forward and is brave enough to be open and honest about this. And obviously you are someone that's clearly had an interest in fringe subjects, as they probably used to be called, but obviously thankfully these days we seem to be a lot more open-minded and have a far more honest conversation about a variety of topics that 40 years ago were perhaps seen as a little bit out there.
Indeed.
Which is probably a lot better for a lot of people, and as you refer to in regards to people's mental health and their own well-being in general. I've often been really intrigued to see about that first time when, obviously, as someone that went into hypnosis working through that experience of having a regressional session, Leslie, was that perhaps the catalyst that enabled you, tailored with your personal interests, to work in this specific niche of hypnotherapy? Because I would imagine a lot of people, with the greatest respect, when they go into hypnotherapy, probably aren't expecting to end up working alongside and for experiences. So was that as big a challenge as it may look to someone like me from the outside, who doesn't really sort of understand the situation in regards to how someone gets referred in regards to these situations?
Well, one thing that I would say in answer to your question is that, you know, not only do I do past life regressions, but I do interlife regressions, which are very fascinating experiences. And what that has to do with is the process that we go through before we come back in to the physical world, into a new body, and the decisions we make, the family we choose, because what I believe is this is a universe of free will and also truth. And I believe that we largely are responsible for the circumstances of the lives into which we incarnate. We might need DNA for some specific reason, but usually in that interim phase is when we understand a life's work or a purpose or an intention or create an intention. So my feeling is that, and from doing so much regression of myself when learning the process, I've been a healer many, many times of different types. And I believe that many, many individuals just like myself and like yourself, we have planned to be here at a very specific time because this is the era of disclosure. It is in the process of occurring, not necessarily through the government channels that we would have hoped, because I think many of the ETs have become frustrated with the greed and the divisiveness of all the political systems, not necessarily that. But I think people like myself, like, you know, our dear friend, who did you just met, Bud Hopkins, Ground Zero, Dr. John Mack, Kathy Martin, these, we are midwives of disclosure. That's the expression that I use. And I'm actually going to write my next book. Well, not the next one. The one after that is going to be a kind of a roundup of individuals who work in the healing modalities of the era of disclosure. So I think the decision rather, it could have, it most likely was triggered by that past life regression, but it was triggered in a way that I remembered in every cell of my body. I remembered what my job was and why all of my experiences in my life, all of my travels, all of my experiences in show business with celebrities here, there, it all was incredible human experience that goes into my, you know, catalog and helps me to work with people, having seen such varieties of behavior and circumstance in my life. So I feel now, Paul, that now I am in the groove, as you will. I'm in the groove right now, and the greatest work is yet to come and is coming. I think one of the unique things that I can contribute is I have been working with a number of what you would call participants in the Secret Space Program. Individuals, not Corey Good specifically, but like Corey Good. I've been working with Randy Kramer, who is one of the most truth-telling of these guys. He's been through, you know, three lie detector tests at Gaia. You know, so I have been working on a lot of this, and many of those individuals have experienced what they call the 20 and back. Are you familiar with that, Paul?
Yes, I am. I am aware of that gentleman and the others involved in these allegations that and situations that they have put forward for a few years, actually, even before I started this show. And obviously, I'm very aware of Corey Good.
I'm, you know, I'm not particularly an endorser of Corey Good, but I will tell you that the vast majority of these individuals that I have worked with are sane, sensible, wonderful people who are living what you would call normal lives today. And yet they began experiencing sort of breakthrough memories. And one of the reasons for this is I've learned, or I've been told, is that if individuals were working with a military grade type of program, they are only able to suppress memories for 20 years. So say someone who had been groomed their whole life, and usually the parents are involved in some way, and they often come from military families. But say you, as an individual, finally were, you know, taken on board the big giant triangle and sent off to, you know, moon base operations for your basic training. From the moment that that happens, time is being played with. And the individuals who are invited to be in the secret space program usually get on board with at least three cloned bodies for parts, spare parts, because there's a lot of combat going on out there, apparently, or there was. So we have some of these dear people who have experienced a very military, maybe combat-related series of encounters. You know, they come back, Paul, with a very specific type of PTSD. This is PTSD, the same way that that it occurred in World War I when it was shell shock, World War II when it was still shell shock, you know, and all the other horrible, brutal experiences that human beings have had. So they come back. So what I'm doing with the experiencers is, not only is it allowing them to process their memories and integrate them, but it's also very much about the healing. And I do all kinds of things with them that I would do with anyone experiencing PTSD. And I work a lot in that. I have a lot of first call responders and people of that sort that experience trauma every day of their lives. So I'm using that to help these experiencers.
I think that is often one of the aspects of this situation, Leslie, that a lot of people are very blasé about it when they, as you touched on earlier, the one thing that's always struck me about the experiencer phenomenon is that, as you referred to earlier, these are people from all backgrounds, all cultures, all races. There is no sort of set template for someone who will come forward. And there is always, it's clearly a developed situation, because the situation from what it was when it first sort of made headlines and became more common in ufology in general, is the fact that there seems to be a real lack of stigma to how it was 30 years ago from people who were coming forward in the 90s, especially, Leslie. And when I've had the opportunity to speak with people who are classed as experiencers or class themselves as experiencers, the one thing I never expected when I first started doing this show was to be as deeply moved and troubled when speaking with these people. And I don't mean troubled in regards to these people and how they were carrying themselves, Leslie. I was troubled and concerned in regards to the fact that I like to think of myself as a person with a lot of empathy. And as someone that finds time and takes time to understand and speak with people and get to the bottom of it. And when I've spoken with several people who have had these situations in their lives, I'm always struck by the fact that, as you've just referred to there, there is so much trauma that these people have had to bottle up and deal with. I find it incredible that some of these people have been able to live a normal life.
Oh, yeah.
And carry on as the rest of us who have never had this situation land in our lives. Because I think often that's the other thing, because people can be very flippant from the outside about these people, Leslie. But in my experience, I've spoken to these people, and my overriding reaction to what they tell me is that this thing has basically eaten away at them for the best part of decades. And I find it fascinating that they've been able to get to a point in their lives as far as they've been able to, due to what they've gone through and what it's done to them, both financially, socially, how it's affected their personal relationships, their family life, their employment. I'm yet to kind of come across anybody who's come out of this in a, I know there are people that feel quite positive about what they've gone through, Leslie, and I'm sure when you've met experiences, some of them treat it as a special moment and they feel blessed in some way. But when I've spoken with people, there is kind of a, as you refer to, a PTSD element to this, that these people are suffering and have essentially learnt to live with what on earth happened to them.
Yes. Well, you're so right. And, you know, we are incredible at suppressing trauma and going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there are people who walked out of the prison camps as teenagers or young adults and never spoke about it again and went on to have hugely productive lives. But at what cost?
Yeah.
You know, the old stiff upper lip thing, because I'm basically, you know, Irish and English, you know, so the stiff upper lip thing was very big in my family. And I think anybody could suppress anything if they had to, you know, really, but it's not healthy. It's and there absolutely have been cases of physical trauma in the abduction scenarios. And I think it might behoove us to talk just for a moment about, again, what I would call ground zero as far as contemporary ET contact. Of course, it has happened all through history, including at Valley Forge to George Washington. And it's something that has always happened. But you may recall, so I'm going to talk about the Roswell crash for just a moment. Mm-hmm. And first of all, there were three crashes, and there were ET survivors. Apparently, there were at least four or five of them that survived initially, and many of those passed, and there was one left. And these particular grays, they were gray beings, they were brought down. They didn't just crash. They were brought down by some type of experimental sonic weapon that the U.S. had. You know, so they were actually made to crash. And there was eventually a diplomatic detente. And now we're talking about the very end of World War II, and we're talking about President Truman. Okay, he was FDR had passed. He was President Truman. So Truman, we call this the Truman Agreement, but Truman and his government were offered a deal by these particular gray aliens. They're Zeta Reticulites, the same beings that encountered Betty and Barney Hill, the same gray beings. So they apparently were having all kinds of physiological troubles and could no longer reproduce, and they have some genetic compatibility with us of some sort. So they said to Truman, you know, we're going to give you, some advanced tech that you can handle, right? But in exchange, we would like to be able to have a carte blanche to take as many a small amount of human beings to harvest their genetic material. They'll never know about it. They'll be unconscious. They won't remember anything. And Truman agrees. And so we got, fiber optic cables, this, that, and the other, Velcro, you name it. So there was a certain amount of, integrated circuits. It was a big leap, big, big leap. And this was the result of sort of harmless technology, but the technology that was given to the U.S. government, and the U.S. government then distributed it amongst big industrialists of the day so that no one industrial company had all of it. And that was the beginning of what they called in the U.S. Army the Department of Foreign Technology. And boy, was it ever foreign technology. So this was an agreement that was a kind of a contract that had an expiration. And so during the Eisenhower years, I believe it was, it was continued along. And at some point, and I'm going to say this was at some point in the 80s, maybe even the late 80s, this agreement ran out. And that is when the aggressive sperm taking, ova taking, genetic experimenting kind of deal stopped. So I don't see it anymore in younger experiencers. It's just not some, that whole thing that, that many people in your age group and my age group went through is now done. And they did keep their word and stop their experiments. But meanwhile, many individuals who are in their, you know, 50s now, have had, incredibly traumatic things happen where, you know, they, genetic material was extracted and they were, and then they were shown children that they were supposed to hold and touch and that were then taken away from them. So these poor people have been through a lot. So Wes Roberts, even in my book, he went through some of that too, and that's in there because he had some peripheral involvement with that kind of program. So what we see now is a lot of individuals sort of begin to wake up in midlife. And I would say that most of the individuals that I see, although they're aware that strange things have happened, you know, they begin to get a, you know, like a kind of a one track mind thing about it, about I've got to get this resolved. I've got to find out. And I think that that is a natural part of the experience and that we are actually supposed to recall after a certain amount of time. I don't think there's a memory block made, alien or human, that cannot be dissolved.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very interesting point, though I suspect that if we went out into the wider world, I would be very interested, like you say there, Leslie. It is remarkable that we seem to have some very notable cases that seem to have happened, especially in the 1970s in the States. There are several major cases that we still talk about 50 years on, as we've, you know, as I've touched on Pascagoula incident with Calvin Parker and Charles Hickson, Terry Lovelace, I think was 1977, Devil's Den, obviously probably the most famous ones, Travis Walton, which was 1975, I think, off the top of my head.
Maybe a little bit earlier, but yes, and Travis, I know Travis, and he said something very interesting to me, the last time that we talked, which wasn't that long ago. Well, by now, COVID, take out 2 years.
Yes.
I guess it was about 3 years ago. It was longer than I think. But what he said is he now believes that when he jumped into that tractor beam, you know, it was an unexpected event. You know, the ETs were out there probably doing some kind of forestry or looking at pollution and doing something very benign out there in the, you know, Snowflake Mountains. And it was a kind of a wrong place, wrong time. Travis ran out, jumped into the beam, and he believes that he actually was killed and that the ETs took him on board to revive him and repair him. Now, he also talked about the fact that, the craft itself seemed to be under the charge of beings that looked just like us. You know, very humanoid beings, I suppose you could say Pleiadians or Arcturians or whatever. They looked just like us. So when he finally woke up and came to consciousness after he had been unconscious for days being healed, the first thing he did was fling around the little gray guys that had been, you know, assisting him. Yes. and they went, whoa, and they ran out, and then two humanoid beings came in who communicated with him telepathically. So, you know, and remember, if you do see the movie Fire in the Sky, which is a wonderful movie, the whole, and I know Tracy Torme well, who wrote the script, you know, Mel Torme's son, one of his sons, but the entire sequence of being aboard the craft, the most terrifying part of the whole thing in Fire in the Sky, where Travis is up there and he goes through his experience, it was a completely conceptual thing created by an Italian director that they brought in to shoot just that sequence. So it is not based on really anything that Travis experienced during those 7 days or however long it was close to a week. And, you know, Travis is by his nature is such a shy person, such a, self-effacing kind of, well, just kind of a lovely person. And I think, boy, this man, you know, his life was ruined by coming out about this for a time. You know, his life was decimated, torn apart, his marriage busted up. I mean, everything happened to him because he told the truth. And, you know, he often says that. He says, you know, if it, you know, I would have had nothing to gain. If this didn't happen, I wouldn't be talking about it. And I believe that. I believe him implicitly.
Yeah. I mean, this is often one of those things when we hear people criticize experiences when they come forward, Leslie, that often they are said, oh, they're just doing it for financial gain. And you can apply this to a wide variety of strange phenomenon, not just the experiencer phenomenon. I can think of numerous people in the field of cryptozoology, witnesses who have come forwards, and they have they've had their personal reputation shredded. I've yet to meet anybody that's become a millionaire for coming out with a story like this.
It's the opposite.
Yes.
One of the most brilliant cryptozoologists with some of the most solid evidence that I've ever seen or heard, Jim Patterson, humble, great guy, living out the woods, not making any money off of anything. He's always being eviscerated and called a liar and a fabulist and all the other. You know, the man has shared evidence with me. There are vocalizations and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, he is a truth teller, and he's one of the first people to talk about the possibility of Sasquatch or the like creatures being interdimensional beings. And, you know, so he's got some opinions that are very metaphysical and not popular with the people that just think they're looking for a big ape, you know, a leftover Miocene ape.
Oh, yeah, that's a very easy way to start an argument in the field of cryptozoology. So I will leave that there.
Okay, well, I'm not, you know, I'm just throwing it out there.
No.
It's not my forte, but that's the one guy that I know.
Oh, no.
You know, but I do see, you know, I get very irritated by the people that are just like hunters, and they want to go out and kill this animal, or,
yes.
You know, I think these are very special people, and I think we need to look to the indigenous peoples and the fact that they have a millennia's long relationship with Yeti and Sasquatch, and they have relationships where they give them food and they exchange presents back and forth.
Yes.
That's the reality of what it should be.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's a joke in the field of cryptozoology that if you ever want to see a room full of cryptozoologists fall out, just put a physical Bigfoot believer and an interdimensional Bigfoot believer in the same room and see what happens.
Well, I think it's stand back. I think it's both, but you know, are there any, and this is so stupid that I don't know this, but, and certainly as Celts, you know, we have our own indigenous people in the United Kingdom. Have there been reports of a Sasquatch-like being in any of the remote areas, like up in Scotland or something like that?
We've got enough here with the Fae, I think, Leslie. Never mind anything else.
Oh yes, indeed. And you know, don't forget about Nessie the plesiosaurs that are trapped in the locks, and we have that in Canada too. Did
yes.
you know that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We have a couple of very famous cryptid plesiosaur-like beings that are trapped in some of the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes are massive.
Yeah.
Massive, just big, you know, and it connects with the ocean through the St. Lawrence Seaway. So.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of my favorite cryptids are there. Ogopogo.
One of my
favorite lake monsters. I do like my Canadian lake monsters.
All right. Well, Ogopogo, you'll have to. Ogopogo seems to pop up a little more frequently than Nessie.
Yes.
But I think that I think it's a bigger space too. You know,
yes.
The Loch is quite deep. What is it? Somebody tell me. could it be 3.5 miles in circumference? Is that right?
Well, I've actually been on Loch Ness.
Ah.
So it's 21 miles long, and it's 2 miles at its widest point.
Mm-hmm.
But it is incredibly deep. It's deeper than the English Channel. So drops to about 760 feet deep.
That's incredible. You can't even go down there as a diver. You'd have to get some kind of, super submarine deal or something. Well, they're always, I'm always fascinated with the new things. They try everything. They try LIDAR, but, it seems logical to me that there could be quite a cave system down there.
Oh, there's definitely something in there. What it is, I don't know, but there's something strange at Loch Ness, no doubt about it. What I've always been interested in as well in regards to the experiencer phenomenon, Leslie, is I would imagine when people come forwards, this is one of the other aspects of this, I think, that often gets overlooked, is that there is the variety of beings that people encounter.
Oh, yes.
So for you, when this first introduced itself to you and you began to speak with people that were having these experiences and wanting to unlock these repressed and shielded memories, how many people did you see until you started to realize that there was a variety of alleged beings that people were encountering? Because obviously, as you touched on earlier with Travis and some of the other famous witnesses, they will describe that they've met people that are very similar to us that may have sort of secondary creatures or some even believe them to be some kind of android or robot. So at that point, obviously, a lot of people say, oh, well, it's just the greys that are taking people. And as you were referring to there about these agreements that have alleged to have been made in the 50s about the technological exchanges for carte blanche in regards to taking subjects, at what point did you start to realize that it wasn't just people weren't just encountering greys, they were bumping into what you would call the Nordics, or even these days I'm always intrigued with people who claim to have had encounters with mantis like creatures as well?
Yes, there are, right away, Paul, I mean, in the first year I was doing this, I was hearing such diverse reports of the physicality of the encountering beings, but yet at the same time, I was also hearing that there is, in fact, sort of a Gene Roddenberry-like United Federation of Planets, and that there are, in fact, space stations, motherships that are just loaded with a massive variety of beings. And some of the beings, whether through panspermia or through a more direct ancient alien approach, we're carrying a lot of DNA from our space brothers and sisters. We are the hybrids already, so there's nothing to really be afraid of. We're carrying all kinds of DNA. Otherwise, we wouldn't have so many anomalies. And, so one of the things that I would say is, look at the diversity of, human form on the planet. We have very tall blonde people. There are people in the islands of the Philippines that are practically hobbits. They're practically just a meter tall. So, or less than a meter rather. But, I think that it was the late great Paul Hellyer. I don't know if you're familiar with Paul Hellyer, but, what a gentleman, what a wonderful man. And Paul Hellyer, to your listeners, was a very important political official. He was the Minister of Defense, and he was also the Vice Premier of the province of Ontario. So he knew a lot about stuff. And the last thing that he told me, and this was not long before he died, is he said he was aware, personally aware, of at least 88 different species that the government of Canada and other combined governments had treaties with or agreements with and had formal diplomatic relations with. So there are a wide variety of species. There are many types of gray, and I do kind of agree with what you mentioned earlier. There are some what we would call gray beings that I believe are not fully biological. They are more like a cybernetic kind of being. And that's because people, humans, when they're on the craft, they have a very hard time communicating with these more drone-like grays. And they'll say, well, I can get like a thought, but there's really not much going on there. Mm. So that's what we get a lot of. Now, there are even reptilian beings mm-hmm. that are benevolent. Indeed, you know, according to Randy Kramer, there are some reptilian varieties that are very warlike, and a lot of the combat that he and his brothers were in, and sisters were involved in, was with angry reptilians. So, who were very good at cybernetics and can sort of mess with your mind. So there is that, but it may surprise you that I've heard an awful lot about mantis beings and that they are extremely benevolent and loving. They're also apparently genetic masters of our, you know, part of the universe. And so when there are children involved, and this is a little disturbing, but when there are children involved, and many of my experiencers have been taken since they were very little children, sometimes from the age of 3 or earlier, when there are children involved, you're usually going to find a mantis being somewhere, because they are the experts in all of this. And they usually go to a lot of trouble to cloak themselves because they don't want to frighten anybody. They know how startling their appearance is to us. So they're not easy to see. It's only when they become comfortable that they will be able to show themselves. And that being said, one of the individuals that I'm working with who is, you know, I mean, he went through some very heavy things. I would almost call him a super soldier in that respect. There's a lot of genetic tune-ups and a lot of stuff happened. But he developed a close relationship with an insectoid being who was almost like a father figure, maybe extreme, but a kind of a guide or a friend or a being to talk to during his whole time in the 20 and back. And the name of this insectoid being is Kern. And Kern would just show up sometimes, and maybe more than we knew. Kern could show up holographically, you know, the idea being that he was maybe in some other part of deep space, but he would be able, if you thought of him, he would just show up and project a kind of holographic image of himself. So there are incredible technologies. You know, we have the ability to do all this stuff, but we're just learning it again. So, but yeah, so there's the insectoids. There were reptilian beings. Now there are beings that, again, many people who are recalling events from when they were children, there are beings that they have with them in the medical procedures. And I don't mean painful procedures. I mean just measuring and just, you know, normal stuff. And the children often call them the brown doctors. Now, I have not been able to get anyone to be able to, you know, look past the cloak and be able to tell me what they really like. But I think that they are a kind of reptilian, but maybe with a humanoid face, if you know what I mean. Mm. So the brown doctors are always there. And that's just a handful. We have, we have beings that are so close to how we look, and they consider us their cousins in that respect. So we have been involved. You know, maybe Earth is the grand experiment. I often hear it referred to as that. But we have been involved with encounters with various beings throughout the very, very beginning of this planet as a sustainable orb. We have been involved. So we are the hybrids. That's what I would like to point out. We are the hybrids. Look at O negative blood, for instance, which I happen to have. But there is no other species on Earth that has a blood type without a coating on its blood cells, the rhesus coating. Mm. Only humanoids. And even within humanoids, O negative blood, the most considered to be the first blood type of the Earth, O negative blood is highly concentrated in the Celtic peoples. I mean, you go out to the, you know, like the Orkney Islands or somewhere out there and take a sample, and you're going to find upwards of 90% of these people are carrying O negative blood. Also the Basque people who live in the Pyrenees.
Yes.
Between Spain and France. They again, you know, their male population, which they've charted, 70-80% of them are carrying O negative blood. So there were different blood type infusions into our species, with O negative being the first, allegedly, and then the other groupings came later with other beings, I guess one must assume. So, and also, you know, it, as human beings, we are vulnerable to over 6,000, I would call them genetic failures, genetic problems, 6,000. Now, what that says to me is, some bad gene splicing. And, you know, whatever went on with us in, you know, accelerating our development or whatever happened, you know, some of it was not done that effectively. There are no other creatures on the face of the earth that are subject to genetic failure in the way that we are.
It's certainly intriguing, Leslie, when you look at it in that regard, because it is remarkable when you look at the world and the fauna and flora that inhabit it, that it does seem that we are sometimes even more unique than we realize. And it is peculiar when you look at this whole situation, because another aspect of it that I've always been deeply interested in is that when people began to come forward in the 50s and claim to have had contact, willingly or unwillingly, one of the situations I find very interesting is that sometimes you can see sort of fashions or trends in regards to what people are sort of saying. When you've been speaking with people, have you noticed any kind of overriding communication that sometimes still goes on? Because obviously when we look back at contactees, as they were called in the 50s, they often would claim that they were being advised about what we were doing wrong and what we needed to change. When you've been speaking with people, has that continued to develop? Or, as you referred to earlier, when we're looking at these people claiming that they're just being picked up for genetic harvesting and experimentation or whatever, is there still that kind of situation that comes forward where when you're speaking with someone, they will advise you or unbridle messages or communications that they've been given on a larger scale than they thought they were even involved in?
All the time. I don't think communication ever stops with experiencers. What I think happens is at a certain point, usually in midlife, experiencers engage with their ET encounters in a kind of a way that's more like an astral projection or even a remote viewing, if you would like to use that term. But the experiencers that I work with, who are lifelong experiencers, every once in a while, they will have a physical experience. But most of the time, they are traveling, you know, in their astral state and even working alongside other ETs on projects. So they have an active partnership. So however this thing started, most of the adult experiencers that I now work with have a kind of a whole nother existence when they should be sleeping or when their body is sleeping, and they are astral projecting, they are engaging, and you know, and when I have these people under hypnosis, they are absolutely free to communicate with the beings around them in real time. And so now we're getting a lot of exactly what you were talking about. We're getting a lot of direct information through the experiencers about why they're here and what they're doing and what their hopes are for us. And I'm telling you that a big concern, and we've been hearing about this since Betty and Barney Hill, a big, huge concern is our lack of regard for our beautiful planet, our pollution, our mess, our nuclear garbage. You know, and the message is still kind of clean up your own backyard. Mm-hmm. Clean up your own backyard. And, you know, and we have a planet here where there are still hungry children. There is still death and war. You know, we've got a lot of stuff going on that many, many races have moved beyond millennia ago. So we're not, you know, I mean, it would be a beautiful thing if we could be invited, you know, to join an organization that involved many different civilizations. But I think at this point, there are more people who are aware than are unaware. So I do have hope. This is not a hopeless situation, but people who don't want to progress, maybe they won't progress. And I don't know exactly what that means. It sounds dire, but I think it's a universe of free will. And I do think that most of the people on the planet now are operating at a higher vibration. Mm. And this is reflected in the political turmoil that we're seeing. We have unaware people and we have very aware people inhabiting the same density, if you will.
Mm. It is intriguing in that aspect. And as we were referring to there, one of the other aspects of this that's always interested me is sleep or the impression of being asleep and mm-hmm. people often being taken during sleep. And as you refer to there, Leslie, I've often considered the fact that people aren't being taken physically in their mm-hmm. sleep. They just feel as if they're being taken. But essentially, because they are asleep, I've often contemplated the fact that is this some kind of psychic transmission that's going on? And people's mm-hmm. psyche or soul or whatever you want to call it is downloaded, uploaded, removed somehow. So the physical body remains in stasis, in bed, resting, and their consciousness is what's actually taken. And it's mm-hmm. that that's kind of utilized. Now, obviously, I know that kind of falls down when we talk about genetic material.
Well, both things happen. Mm. You're absolutely right. Both things happen. And the physical parts seem to happen more in earlier life, which makes more sense. Why wouldn't they want young DNA mm-hmm. unpolluted by whatever it is that we've done in our adult lives? Why wouldn't yes. they want young DNA? But I think that we are, as the amazing beings that we are, I think we are all able to bilocate and engage with our etheric bodies or our psychophysical bodies or whatever you want to call it. I mean, the great yogis, many of them have been seen at 2 and 3 places at the same time. Mm-hmm. This is something that we as humans are capable of. We just have forgotten, you know, how to do it, but lots of people do it naturally. I mean, lots of people who are not involved with any kind of ET stuff at all will tell me, well, I astral projected and I went to my son's house and I walked around and blah. So we can do it, but I think it's an encouraged way to engage because it's just easier, much less trauma on the body, much easier. So we do a lot of that. And, a couple of people, not only men, but a couple of women who were in the secret space program have told me that they were taught how to bilocate with the help of some kind of special chair or device. And they started out by just being able to go up into the corner of the room. And then eventually they learned how to completely send their consciousness. And, that has been used, I think, for some nefarious military purposes as well. But in general, that this bilocation, traveling at the speed of thought, traveling in your lighter body, that's what's happening a lot of the time.
Mm. I'm often intrigued as well. Often when people try to criticize experiences, especially ones that claim to have encounters whilst they're in bed, Leslie, that people simply say, oh, well, it's just sleep paralysis. Now, I've had one incident in my life of sleep paralysis, and it was quite frightening, but I knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't get out of it it felt like minutes, but it was probably 10 seconds at that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a very disconcerting experience, I have to say. And I find it interesting that often people will dismiss some of these situations as people just having sleep paralysis episodes. And yet, when you dive into the experience of situation, there are very few that I can think of. Obviously, you know, I will bow to your further knowledge in this subject, Leslie. There are very few situations or witnesses that I can recall who will talk about being laid in bed and unable to move. Often people will just go. In your experience, is that really a valid excuse for some of these situations? Because I'm I find sleep paralysis seems to have been embraced by certain sections of the paranormal community as a as an explanation for everything that goes on. And I
know.
But it's also very easy for skeptics to use. And I think both sides of the coin are sometimes wrong in that regard.
I agree. Well, first we should probably look at, you know, exactly what sleep paralysis is. And it's a very, very, very human thing. And the reason that it happens is we release certain paralytic chemicals into our body so that we don't act out our dreams. And it's part of how the whole sleep dream mechanism works. But when we are going into a deep state where dreaming is occurring, the body simply releases these paralytic chemicals so that you don't walk around in your room or your house to the danger of yourself and everyone else acting out what's happening in your dreams. This is a necessary thing because the mind does not know the difference between dreams and reality. It doesn't. So this is what we, you know, this is a thing that often happens. Now, if you should begin to come to consciousness before those paralytic dream chemicals have worn off, that is sleep paralysis. You are paralyzed, but it's only moments, and it's a natural thing. Now, sleep paralysis in no way, in my opinion, sleep paralysis in no way explains the thousands of encounters that I have probably helped people through. It's a thing that happens, but it's not related to, you know, a hag sitting on your chest or any of these other things. That sleep paralysis is real. You just take a few breaths. Your body will come back to wakefulness and you get up. It can be scary, but it is not the same thing. It is a human thing. It's a human thing. It has nothing to do with paralytic chemicals that were being given by the ETs or anything like that. So, you know, my kids experienced it, especially it happens a lot in the tween years, you know, tween and teen years. Sometimes they used to call them night terrors, things like that. Sleep disturbances like that happen a lot to young tweens. But it is frightening when it happens, but in my opinion, and I'm sure, you know, we'll have people arguing this, but in my opinion, sleep paralysis is a physical humanoid event that is in fact a kind of a normal thing and is not related to the abduction phenomena.
Is it something that, I mean, obviously one of the interesting things I've been made aware of over the last few years is when people try to dismiss experiences, one of the easiest and I think rather tasteless excuses put forward is that these people are mentally ill or they're suffering mental illness, Leslie. Yeah. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe in Canada, it's illegal for you to treat somebody who's been clinically diagnosed as suffering mental illness. They have to be referred. And if they have a history of mental illness, they can't be hypnotized. Is that right?
Well, you are exactly right. That is a mandate. I cannot hypnotize or work with anyone who has been diagnosed with a mental illness. Now, within that, what that means to me, diagnosed with a mental illness, we're not talking about people who are nervous or have a bit of anxiety or a bit of depression. We're talking about a dissociative disorder, schizophrenia, borderline personality disorder, bipolar disorder, and, you know, psychosis even. So that's what we're talking about. So what is essential for me is to be able to figure out if someone who has contacted me is having a mental health issue. And I'll be quite honest, you know, not everybody that contacts me is an experiencer. There's always going to be a percentage of people who are unstable. And, you know, one thing that gives me a bit of an edge, you know, having been a psychiatric technician dealing with extremely mentally ill people, I don't think anyone gets past me. If you ask the right questions, and even they won't, you know, they probably won't tell you the truth, but that's not maybe the reason why you ask the questions you do. But if you ask the right questions, and if you're observant, I'm also a neuro-linguistic programmer, so that's a little bit like someone who can look at your face and tell if you're lying or not, like that kind of thing. So I use a lot of that stuff, and I use my own instinct. And as far as a person who has come to me for an experiencer situation, I can say in all those years, maybe it's only been between 3 and 5 people that were really mentally unwell, and I had to, and then I don't hang them out to dry. I simply send them to a psychologist friend of mine who is open to the idea of experiences. Mm. So, you know, I don't hang those people out to dry. I get them help, but I get them the help. I get them the help that I feel that they need. And what they don't need is to have their fantasies and their paranoia blown up, you know, by some type of fictitious journey, hallucinatory journey, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's really, really important to me, Paul. But after this, I'm about to go back to school and take another master's. So before too long, you know, I won't have that kind of regulation to worry about.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it is good to hear, though, that there is this framework of support that if these people do come across your path, Leslie, you can refer them to the correct channel and get them the support they need.
Yes, always. I always do that, you know, and I, whether it's somebody I think would need medication, I have psychiatrists that I work with, or whether they simply need to talk it out or there's trauma, then, you know, a psychologist or a psychotherapist. So I make sure that they get the help that they need.
Are you still surprised by some of the experiences that you encounter, Leslie, as your life and skills have developed? Are there still occasions that you're taken aback by people's stories and experiences coming out?
All the time. It is endlessly fascinating. And there is an endless variety of experience. And, you know, everybody's experience, yes, there are certainly a lot of commonalities, but everybody's experience is unique to them. And even within the huge multi-zillion billion dollar of whatever military programs we're involved with and other governments, even within that, you know, people are all doing different things. I worked with an experiencer about a month ago, and she had a fascinating job where she worked on craft, and this was during the 20 and back. She was like a maybe even like a zoologist, I don't know, but she worked on the craft, and she worked with maintaining and studying different species of animals from different planets. Some aquatic, some, you know, but that was, and I had her tell me about all the different animals, and I'm telling you, that was one of the most fascinating things I've heard about in a long time.
That sounds remarkable. That is quite a unique experience, situation, I would find out. I would imagine you've probably never come across that kind of experience before.
No, I never come across that. And sometimes there are beings that are aquatic, that, you know, sometimes people have contact with some really unusual beings that are like mer people. They exist on some part of our galaxy somewhere. Oh gosh, so many fascinating things have happened, and so many fascinating things that I've heard. I've heard some wonderful stories of healing.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, one of the experiencers I work with had developed a very severe case of pneumonia. Now, this was way back in the early 70s. We didn't have the antibiotics we have today. People could still die of pneumonia. Mm-hmm. We still had oxygen tents, the whole thing. So the memory of my experiencer is like this. He remembers being in hospital, being in and out of consciousness, and being in a kind of an oxygen tent. And one of the beings that he identified as the beings that he contacts just walked up to his hospital bed in like a doctor's gown and such. And then the being put their hands inside of his chest. Now, of course, this was probably an etheric projection of some kind. We don't know, but the hands literally went inside the chest. No pain, nothing like that. And there was some glowing and some warmth and some heat. And immediately after that procedure was over, my friend who was a teenager the fever broke and it was over. The pneumonia was gone.
Goodness.
Yeah. So there have been many tales of healing, mm-hmm. where, you know, beings are working with certain people and there's an accident, there's this, there's that. It's amazing. So there are many positive things, amazing things going on. And if we could just join for the sense of knowledge and support with these wonderful beings that surround us, imagine what the world could be. Imagine eliminating hunger. Imagine eliminating cancer. You know, it's all doable. And unfortunately, we have been lied to and misled by our own governments because these technologies have already been used on people that participate in the secret space program. And probably, as far as I know, heavyweight politicos, too, and other important people. Although I'm not a paranoid person. I'm not like a cabal Illuminati person, if you know what I mean. I'm not into that, but imagine if we could lift ourselves up by our bootstraps, if we could generate love instead of swinging hate, if we could cure, if we could feed the people. I mean, it's that basic. If we could, we have the technology. We have the technology. We can form the world into anything that we can envision.
Absolutely. I think you can always judge a society on how it treats the least fortunate in it.
Oh, yes. Who was it? It said that brilliant thing. That is, isn't that a quote? You said it. Paul said it. Close enough.
Well, thank you. I'll take that. I'll take that kudos. I think the last point I want to touch on before I let you leave after this fascinating conversation, Leslie, is that often there is a situation where experiences, it seems to be a generational thing.
Oh, yeah.
When you come across cases like this, is there a fear of grandparents and parents that they don't want their children to experience what they've gone through? Or often is it too late? It's already happened. Or have you seen situations where a parent and a child have been taken at the same time, or a grandparent and a grandchild have been taken at the same time?
All the time. All the time. This is by and large, if there is a following of genetic lines. And again, is it because they're looking for, they know how to identify the gene, the psychic gene? They know how to identify it and they're just looking for it as it passes through various familial lines. Mm-hmm. Or are certain species just tracking their own relatives? The amount of alien DNA that's in there. You know, I mean, it's there definitely is generational tracking. And I guess what I have found is most experiencers that are talking to me, their parents and grandparents have completely shut down the experience. In other words, it's not unusual for a person who's very young, 4 or 5, and they get taken and their mother goes too. Mm. Not unusual, but the parent will never talk about it. So we're seeing a lot of, it's very hard to get information about that out of older relatives. They seem to be more shut down than they are open. And, but again, I guess that depends entirely on the relatives. You know, we're dealing here in Canada with a C of E, majority, mainline Christians, you know, and this is still, would have been still out of the range for many people who would be grandparents, to say myself. My grandparents would be 100 years old now or more.
Yes.
So it just wasn't something they talked about, or they gave it a religious bent.
Mm.
Like that's a friend of mine actually who happens to be experienced. I don't treat her, but she's a friend of mine. She says, well, what happened to me is my mother saw, you know, the lady, like the Pleiadian lady who used to come to get me every once in a while. And my mother thought that she was an angel.
Mm.
So there would be a religious, application sometimes put to these things, which is why I was mentioning General George Washington earlier at Valley Forge, which was the definitive moment. Mm. He encountered a craft and three beings that he believed were angels.
Mm.
So, you know, we're going to have a religious iconography a lot of the time when you go back to grandparents. They're not necessarily going to tell the truth, but our families abducted together, most certainly. In fact, I'll tell you a very quick story, just super quick. This is a person I only saw once, but he had a lot of partial memories of things that had happened, came from a big family, one, two, three, four kids, I think. And he and his family were coming back from Quebec, and Quebec is a lot of wilderness. It's very, you know, remote. And so they were coming back from Quebec, and it was the middle of the night, and all of a sudden the father, who was driving, turned off on a non-road, you know, just like a path, you know, off the highway, and just started driving. And then my client, who was a little boy at the time, probably about six, he said then he saw Boy Scouts riding on bicycles next to the car. Now, here's a screen memory. We didn't talk about screen memories at all, really, but in that case, his memory was being manipulated to see, you know, what was actually beings traveling along the side of the car. He was seeing Boy Scouts riding bikes, or Cub Scouts, rather, sorry. So the father kept driving down the road, and then the car stopped, and the entire road was filled with what you would call gray beings, and the car windows came down, and the gray beings started levitating the children out of the car, which was like a station wagon. I think the parent beings were like in a coma, and they walked them up, but the children were levitated, and they were, not all of them were awake, but it was terrifying for this individual. And he said the most frightening thing is he looked over and he saw his brother, his older brother, who was terrified, and he couldn't help him in any way.
Mm.
So the whole family was taken, and I believe that individual, I only saw him once, but I think that he did say that there were a couple of other events, contact events, in which his brother, that same brother, joined him. But then he was eliminated at a certain point, and just my client continued on. So they're looking for something, but taking families and siblings together, I would say that's a very common event.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. It's almost as if we've only scraped the surface of these, because I always find those kind of encounters remarkable, where, you know, as you say, brothers and sisters look across, yeah, during a crazy situation, Leslie, and see one of their siblings going through a similar thing, and there is often that look of terror on their relative's face at the time.
Yes, it was traumatizing because of what happened. Nothing painful happened, but because the kids were terrified. They weren't all asleep as they should have been. But that was a real abduction. I mean, floating them out the car windows.
Yeah.
And I remember he said he was trying to grab his brother, but he couldn't move. It was really something. And, you know, and when people are relating these things to me, you know, their tears are running down their faces. And this is, you know, this is the thing that doesn't happen when people make stuff up, unless they're phenomenal actors. So could someone fool me? Maybe, but not too likely.
Yeah.
Genuine emotion is what I see happen. And I'll just throw out there just real quick, when I'm working in regression with an experiencer, I don't ever allow them to re-experience something traumatic. Mm. If we get to an uncomfortable point in the memories, I turn them into an observer so they can still process what happened, but without any kind of pain or worry or fear.
Yes, we've got to look after them regardless, because like you say, the thing that when we're dealing with situations like this, Leslie, is that for some people, these are traumatic memories that have been locked away for a reason.
Yes, yes, yes. But knowledge is power. And I have never, people come to me, they can't sleep, they're on all kinds of medications, they're going to see a psychiatrist. And when they begin to understand who they are, and they begin to, and I'm not talking about people with mental illness, I'm talking about neurotic stuff going on. So when they begin to move through the memories and process them, they begin to get in touch with their original purpose. They begin to realize how special they are. And the whole thing can really turn around.
And I suppose that's the best result for everybody involved.
And so it is, Paul, and so it is. My concern is the mental and physical and spiritual health of these dear people who have been selected for a variety of reasons, many of which we don't yet understand.
Well, long may your work continue, Leslie, and thank you for sharing some of your insights, knowledge and cases with me today. Where can everybody keep up to date with your work, get a hold of your book?
With Wes?
Put my teeth back in, yes. Where can everybody get hold of a copy of your book with Wes, Intersection?
Oh, thank you. Well, my book with Wes Roberts is called Intersections, A True Story of Extraterrestrial Contact. And you can get that on Amazon.com, Amazon.uk, Amazon.ca, wherever you Amazon, that book is available. And also, Wes Roberts has written a very fascinating book. I had nothing to do with it, but his new book is called An Experiencer's Garden, and it's got a lot of drawings in there. It's very cool. So that is also available on Amazon.com or Amazon.uk. And you can always find me through Facebook, or I'm on Facebook both as Leslie Mitchell Clark and also Lightwork Hypnosis. And you can always email me at Leslie, spelled the female way, which you guys in the UK know very well, L-E-S-L-E-Y, Leslie at lightworkhypnosis.com. And that's all one word, lightworkhypnosis.com. So Facebook, lightworkhypnosis.com, and you will find me, and I promise to get back to you, even if you just want to chat for a bit.
That's fantastic. Well, I'll put the links to all those contacts in my show notes for the episode, as always. Leslie, thank you so much for your time today. It's been lovely to speak to you, and thank you for giving me such a wonderful insight into your work and the people you've had the experience of working with.
Oh, Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this very important subject, and I appreciate your openness and your knowledge, and I would love to come back and visit you again whenever you'll have me.
You're very welcome. I will hold you to that. You take care.
I will. You too, Paul. Bye now.